Carlos Aguilar, and this is your call. On Monday, ExxonMobil claimed the number one spot on the Fortune 500 list, bumping Walmart to the number two spot. Last year, ExxonMobil reported $486 billion in revenues, which is more than most countries. ExxonMobil not only benefited from rising oil prices, but also from its fast-growing business in fracking. Exxon now produces just about as much gas as it does oil. In his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power, today's guest, Steve Cole, writes, quote, "As it expanded, Exxon refined its own foreign security and economic policies. In some of the faraway countries where it did business, because of the scale of its investments, Exxon's sway over local politics and security was even greater than that of the United States Embassy." Cole describes Exxon as a, quote, "corporate state within the American state." The company wields a corporate system of secrecy, non-disclosure agreements, and internal security that matched some of the most compartmented black boxes of the world's intelligence agencies. Some Exxon employees call its headquarters near Dallas the Death Star. So how did Exxon become the largest and most powerful private corporation in the United States? And how does it exercise its power domestically and internationally? Steve Cole is author of the best-selling book, The Bin Ladens, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning bestseller, Ghost Wars. He's president of the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan public policy institute in Washington, and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Steve Cole worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism in 1990. And he traveled to seven countries to do research for his new book, Private Empire. And Steve Cole joins me here in studio. Hi, Steve. Thanks for coming in.
Rose, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So 600 pages, you traveled to seven countries. You spent 4 years to write this book. Why did you decide to focus specifically on ExxonMobil?
Well, actually, I started out on this project not focusing specifically on ExxonMobil. I wanted to write about oil and American power in an era of constraint and limits after 9/11, try to dig into how the world really works in the oil economy. And I got out into the field about 6 months in, and I thought, you know, I really need to focus on a single company to tell a story. And at that point, for American readers, it seemed obvious I should choose ExxonMobil. So I sort of felt like they chose me once I was underway, and I didn't know that much about them at the beginning. And then I turned to focus on them and found them to be a fascinating company in and of themselves, very unusual.
And now they are number one on the Fortune 500 list, bumping Walmart to number two. They go back and forth quite a bit.
Yeah,
right?
It was interesting. You know, I went back and looked at that list all the way back to the late 40s, and they're the only corporation that's been on it every year since like 1950, and in the top five. I mean, in the top five every year since 1950. It was sort of sad to look at the companies that had disappeared from the list in the post-war period, like U.S. Steel, for example. But this year, three of the top five are oil companies. So that really tells you that this is kind of an idiot-proof business.
Well, you know, just reading your book, 600 pages, and I got through most of it, I'll say.
You're very brave. I really appreciate it.
You know, we often, because we're thinking about the Middle East and oil and corporate influence on the U.S. government and the revolving door between oil companies and the U.S. government, we really want a simple answer here. But after reading this, it almost gave me a headache because there is no simple answer.
Yeah, it's as complex as the economy we've built, the houses we've built, the lives we live. And that was my purpose, was to try to bring that complexity out in a way that people could really understand and absorb. And it does make your head hurt at times because the scale of the energy economy that we've built is almost mind-boggling. And it's truly global. In the way that it's constructed.
One of the facts that I think listeners would really find interesting is that you report 3/4 of the roughly 20 million barrels of oil the U.S. consumes each day is transportation fuel, and the rest goes to industrial uses such as the manufacture of plastics.
Yeah. I mean, chemical manufacturing and plastic manufacturing accounts for about a third of our oil consumption. And oil is not just the basis for gasoline, but also, of course, aviation fuel and diesel and everything else that we use to move around. And the other thing about it is that you look out at the possibilities for change, and it's not just the United States that's at issue. China and India are rising up as industrialized democracies in the case of India, and those middle classes are going to want to have as many cars in the garage as Americans did a generation ago.
And ExxonMobil knows this, and they put this in their 2030 plan, which was also so interesting to read about. So talk a little bit about that 2030 plan, because I think it gives those of us who really want alternatives to oil a sense of what we're actually going to face in the next 10, 20 years.
Right. So ExxonMobil, every year, they have this very rigorous forecast department that looks out 20, 30 years. The book describes the 2030 plan. Just this year, they moved to a 2040 plan. And essentially what they do is they forecast the future of the global energy economy. And they do it not by trying to guess what the prices for different things will be, like oil prices, but they look at demand. Who's going to be buying gasoline? Who's going to be buying aviation fuel? Who's going to be buying ship fuel? Who's going to be buying electricity all over the world, country by country? And then they build a portrait of what the demand for oil, coal, wind power, solar power will be 30 years from now. And everything they do is focused on that forecast. And what they believe the math shows, what their analysis shows, is that oil and natural gas will be embedded in the world energy economy for at least three or four decades. The other thing they do in this exercise that I found really interesting was that they look for game-changing technological breakthroughs that might undermine their own business. So they're constantly studying batteries and wind and solar to make sure that they're not missing something that could change the game really quickly. And the only technology that I think, in my research, I found them a little bit anxious about is batteries. They're not completely sure that there might not be some big breakthrough in battery storage capacity that could make all electric cars really viable sooner than they otherwise believe.
And the one thing they got wrong in their forecast is the oil price itself.
Right.
But everything else, is it based on science? I mean, can we look at this plan and say this is probably where we're going to be in the year 2030?
Yeah, the statistics are pretty reliable because they correlate to population growth and economic growth. And you can look backwards and see that the correlations between energy use and when middle classes form, when certain amounts of per capita income go into households, when a country is industrialized, that they all consume energy basically in a steady pattern all around the world. Doesn't matter what culture you're in, you basically are going to want a refrigerator and a washing machine at the same time that you can afford it, you know, as your neighbors can afford it and so forth. So, yeah, the reason they shifted to this forecasting is they found they could accurately forecast demand and supply, but they could not accurately forecast price because price is subject to speculative bets and global events like wars and other things they can't really predict.
So they conclude that worldwide energy demand would grow by about 35% by 2030, and demand for oil and gas liquids would rise by about 22% to 108 million barrels per day.
Yeah, and most of that would be outside the United States. In fact, probably all of it will be outside the United States.
How incredible are these numbers?
I mean, they're mind-boggling. They really are. And you think about the huge industrial operations all around the world that are necessary to support that supply, all of the oil platforms in deep water, in the Arctic, on, you know, in national forests in this country, the gargantuan global scale of the daily production and the high risk that is involved every day is hard to get your mind around until you really stare at it.
It's incredible because they do really spend a lot of time on India and China and looking at the rapidly growing middle classes there who might want two cars and, as you said, a washer and a dryer. And the other interesting thing is you report that their executives get really frustrated when they hear environmentalists talk about wind and solar because that does nothing for example, the manufacture of plastics, and it does nothing to run a car.
Right. Certainly not unless we have all electric cars and wind and solar are generating all of the power in the country, and then we're plugging into, recharging stations that are fired by windmills. But the spread, the sheer scale, you know how much land use would be required in the United States, even if we had solar panels that were 10 times more efficient than the ones we have now, in order to generate enough solar electricity to recharge all the cars that we have if we converted them to all electric vehicles, you know, you'd have to occupy an astonishing proportion of America's landmass to do that. So we need new breakthroughs. We've got to get there, is my view. I mean, global warming is a serious enough risk to humankind to justify the expense and the changes necessary to move away from high carbon fuels. But we have to be realistic about how hard that transition will really be.
And you really hadn't studied global warming in detail before you embarked on this book.
No, I mean, I was a dilettante reader about the science and the debates, but I really dug into it. And the conclusion that I reached was that, yes, for the oil industry, this really is an existential threat because it is the one form of pollution, in effect, that they can't address by just being regulated or being better operators or cleaning up their messes the way they do with, say, oil spills or air pollution. They've been confronted by challenges to their legitimacy and their business as polluters, but they've managed those challenges by just adapting to regulation. And in global warming's case, you really can't do that because ultimately we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions if we want to prevent warming from occurring. And that means we have to use less oil and coal for sure. And over time, probably less natural gas as well, too. And so that's really if global warming were not a threat, the oil industry would look secure for at least another century. But it is a threat. So somehow the world is going to have to square the circle. And that really seemed interesting to me, not just as a public policy matter, but also looking at how this giant energy economy might eventually change.
So what do these executives at the largest and most powerful corporation in the country, how do they see this playing out? We have their 2030 plan, but how do they see this playing out?
Well, their thinking about it has changed. You know, when the Kyoto Accords were enacted in 1997, they basically challenged the legitimacy of the science. They were really quite extreme, even radical in the campaigning they did against this science. There were a lot of companies and a lot of politicians who didn't like the Kyoto Accords on fairness grounds, on economic grounds, but ExxonMobil was pretty well alone among major corporations in challenging the science, really polluted the public atmosphere for a few years in casting doubt on the science. Then in 2005, when the chief executive of that time, Lee Raymond, retired, ExxonMobil shifted its position. For a little while, they said, we were never wrong, we were only misunderstood. In 2009, they came out in support of a price on carbon-based fuels for the first time in the company's history. So that addresses your question directly. Looking ahead, what they really want is a stable environment for oil and gas drilling. And they recognize that some price on carbon-based fuels to address global warming is coming. It's already been enacted in Europe and Australia. It's probably coming in the United States once we get out of this recession. So what they would like is for that price to be reasonable and stable so they can go about their business. So they've stopped fighting it in principle, but they want to manage it.
We're speaking with Steve Cole about his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. And he writes about the largest, most powerful private corporation in the U.S. They just claimed the number one spot on the Fortune 500 list, bumping Walmart to the number two spot. They reported $486 billion in revenues, which is more than most countries. So what do you want to know about the largest and most powerful corporation in the United States? Steve Cole describes Exxon as a, quote, corporate state within the American state. What questions do you have about ExxonMobil and their influence both here in the U.S. and around the country? And we'll talk with Steve about the countries he visited, including Indonesia, to find out what influence they have overseas. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And then also, if you'd like to ask Steve, after doing such extensive research, what his thoughts are about geopolitics and all of these major, major issues we're facing it, when it comes to the Middle East and oil and invasions. I mean, there's so many things that issues that come up around just talking about one massive corporation like ExxonMobil. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it, or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about this corporate state within the American state. It really is amazing to read about how much power they have in this country.
Yeah, I started out thinking, well, they look to me like a sovereign entity, like a country unto themselves. And one of the things that was surprising to learn was that, yeah, that's how they see it too. They sort of think of themselves as independent sovereigns, and also not tied to the United States particularly. They're headquartered here. Of course, they follow our law. They pay more taxes here than elsewhere. But basically, they see themselves as a global entity. Most of their employees are non-Americans, and they have become untethered, like some other large global corporations, untethered from the American sort of national system. In the 60s, I think during the Cold War, corporations and the government worked more closely together in the common cause of confronting the Soviet Union. But in the last 20 years, these corporations have become global entities unto themselves.
And they have access to the White House. You write that they had about the same amount of access under the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. A lot of people just assume that they had an easy door in because of Dick Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton and the vice president of the United States. And he was friends with ExxonMobil chairman, former chair Lee Raymond. But first, talk about access to the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I think the Clinton administration was a very savvy fundraising operation, among other things. And the Democratic National Committee under Clinton built really strong ties to all the major industrial corporations in the United States and tried to entice them into the Democratic Party and to say, you know, that we're not hostile to business. And they tried to prove that day to day in terms of the open door policy that they offered to chief executives. Also at that time, in the post-Soviet era, in Central Asia, oil figured in the Clinton administration's strategy to kind of contain Russia, and they wanted American oil companies to work with them on some pipelines and things they were doing. So that was another reason. But the Obama administration is described by ExxonMobil's sort of lobbyists and consultants as a different kettle of fish, because Obama had never gone out and raised money from industrial America before. He didn't have relationships in the executive suite, so the big corporations. And when ExxonMobil tried to get right with the Democrats after 2006, their strategy was to go to Hillary because that was who they knew, and they felt like this would be a return of the Clinton administration. And so they were really invested in her campaign.
And what was their relationship with Hillary Clinton, and do they still have a relationship with her?
Well, a couple of their most important executives who work on political strategy were really active Hillary Clinton supporters, had basically gone out and knocked on doors for her during the primary season and really believed. And there were multiple connections to Hillary Clinton's world. Very important advisors of her were close to ExxonMobil folks. And so they knew each other. And they had, obviously, Hillary Clinton is not a shill for big oil, but she had a sophisticated understanding of who they were, was respectful and open to their perspective, and was raising money from their networks and so forth. And so when Obama defeated her in the primary, I think ExxonMobil really was a little bit out of position. They didn't have the same kind of connections the Obama campaign. And then Obama campaigned heavily against ExxonMobil and Big Oil during the summer of 2008. Gasoline prices were high. He was trying to tar McCain with association with Dick Cheney and the failed policies of the Bush administration and so on. And he declared during the campaign, we must end the age of oil. So he could hardly sort of invite the ExxonMobil chief executive over to the White House once he took office. So.
And also what's interesting is in this day and age, you have multinationals giving money to both Democrats and Republicans, but the majority, overwhelming majority of ExxonMobil's contributions go to Republicans, about 90%.
90% in the 2010 cycle, even more in the first months of reporting in the 2012 cycle. And that, as you say, it really makes them unusual among large American corporations that are active with political action committees. Even companies, I was surprised to learn as I looked at the data, like Dow Chemical or Walmart, which you wouldn't think of as particularly enamored of the Democratic Party, actually split their money about 50-50 in order to maintain a kind of a balanced set of conversations with whoever's in office.
We're speaking with Steve Cole, author of the new book, Private Empire. And let's hear from a few of our listeners. Let's go to Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Steve, I have a question for you. There's some figures that was thrown around a few years ago about the finite nature of oil itself. How long do you think it will be possible to drill for oil? I mean, I'm sure it's going to run out at one point. And the second thing is, you know, it's difficult to project those things, but what do you think a gallon of gas will cost in 5 years?
So peak oil, the end of oil, is a great subject and often predicted, but has never arrived. Even just 6-7 years ago, there was a very influential book from a industry analyst who said we're past the peak and the total amount of oil in the world is now in decline. But that doesn't seem to be the case. In fact, there are vast new sources of oil opening up in deep water. And frankly, as global warming accelerates and sea ice melts in the Arctic, massive amounts of oil are being essentially made available that were previously frozen and locked under that ice. So I don't think we're at the geological peak yet. The political constraints to accessing some of this oil are severe, but geologically, I don't think we're there yet. Obviously, you're correct. It is a finite resource. Eventually, it will run out, but I don't think in the next century that's likely.
And so they just plan to drill wherever they think they can find oil?
Wherever they can own it. They want to own it. They don't want to just drill as a contractor for someone else's oil. And that makes their world smaller because of this phenomenon of resource nationalism that grew up in the 70s in the post-colonial world, where most companies that were strong enough to keep foreign corporations out from owning their oil did so. And so that has left ExxonMobil in the odd position of having to work in a lot of weak countries in Africa and elsewhere that can't do it themselves.
Right, and we'll talk about that after the break, because what you uncovered is incredible, especially what happened in what happens in Indonesia. What about the Arctic, though? I'm watching this so closely because, well, it's obviously such a pristine area, and it's so hard to envision these tankers in the Arctic and this deep, deep drilling. And people say that if you had a spill, it'll make Katrina and the Deepwater Horizon look like a cakewalk.
I think you're dead right. I mean, the reality is
not
that
Katrina.
These come.
Deepwater Horizon.
Deepwater Horizon.
Right.
I mean, you're dead right, because the reality of the way the global oil industry works right now is that these companies are being pushed faster and faster into high-risk drilling frontiers. That's their business model, because if you and I, if there were no politics in the world and we decided we needed enough oil to drive our cars, we would basically stay out of all these high-risk areas if we could and work just with the safe pools of oil in the Middle East, and let's suppose there were no wars and no troubles. That's where the easiest oil is. But for political reasons, that oil isn't available, and so people are going out and chasing high-risk drilling opportunities that they would otherwise abjure. And it's a little bit like aviation in the early days. You know, we used to crash a lot of planes before we figured out how to fly safe. And I'm afraid in a place like the Arctic and in deep water, we're learning that these companies are out there betting their reputation every day, doing things that they know they feel like they can control, but they haven't practiced in these environments as much as you might wish.
And right now, Exxon they're going to the Arctic, right? They're on their way.
They made a big deal with a Russian company, Rosneft, to go up there and drill at it. I mean, the size of the deal that's contemplated is almost beyond comprehension. It's many tens of billions of dollars over the next 20 years.
And so basically it's up to the Obama administration to give this the go-ahead?
It's the Russian government's business. Obama has nothing to do with it.
So this is a done deal then?
It's on paper, but in Russia, having something on paper is a beginning, but then you actually have to go through and execute it, and the government there sometimes changes its mind about who it wants to do business with.
We're speaking today with Steve Cole, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. And ExxonMobil just got the number one spot on the Fortune 500 list, bumping Walmart to the number two spot. They are the largest and most powerful private corporation in the United States, $486 billion in revenue last year. And you're listening to Your Call. We'll be back after this. And we're taking just a quick break to ask you to support KALW and independent radio. This is the first day of our May membership campaign. So please take this opportunity to increase your involvement with KALW and help build the base of support for this institution. You can become a member or renew your membership today at kalw.org. And you're listening to Your Call. 100% of our show is funded by you. We could not be here without you. We are corporate free. And what's really incredible about this show is we have the independence to spend an entire hour talking about the largest and most powerful corporation in the world. Unfortunately, that is unique at this time when you think about media, monopolies, and just really sound bites. We live in a soundbite world. So support this kind of radio, an entire hour talking about ExxonMobil. You can get your hands on Steve Cole's new book for a $120 donation by going to KALW.org. That's KALW.org. We never sell or share your private information. $120 will get you Steve Cole's new book about ExxonMobil, the largest and most powerful corporation in the U.S. Steve Cole says this is a corporate state within the American state. The company wields a corporate system of secrecy, non-disclosure agreements, and internal security that matches black boxes of the world's intelligence agencies. This is the kind of information we need to know. And it would be really hard to know this without independent media. $120 will send you Steve Cole's new book, KALW.org. Maybe you just found us on the dial, or maybe you just found us online, and the way it works is we are totally independent. You will never hear this show is brought to you by ExxonMobil because we're listener supported. So let's keep it that way. KALW.org. We do not sell or share your personal information, and we don't get any money from NPR in Washington. We don't share any resources with other radio stations. We are completely independent, and we like it that way, so we can continue doing these hard-hitting shows about corporations, the largest corporations in the U.S. KALW.org. $100 will get you Steve Cole's new book. He spent 4 years on this book. He traveled to 7 countries to investigate this book, and we'll be talking about what he found in Indonesia. Fascinating, fascinating stories. KALW.org. $120 will get you this book. We are living in an age of unprecedented change when we're talking about the economy and the environment. We're going to see major changes over the next few years, and we need independent media to talk about it. KALW.org. And thank you for supporting independent local public radio. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show, yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And tomorrow we will have a conversation with anarchists to talk about the relevance of anarchism today. In the mainstream, the perception is that anarchy is synonymous with black masks, leaderless chaos, and property destruction. But many anarchists are creating positive solutions to social problems. So where are successful anarchist communities, and how do their economies function? If you self-identify as an anarchist, what does that word mean to you? We'd love to hear from you tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about social justice and art. What role do artists play in social movements? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Steve Cole about his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. ExxonMobil just hit Walmart out of their number one spot. So ExxonMobil has the top spot in the Fortune 500, bumping Walmart to the number two spot. So if you have any questions about ExxonMobil and the influence they have both here in the U.S. and abroad, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks for calling in, Roger. Let's go to our next caller, Philip in Oakland. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. A couple of questions. First question is, how much of Obama's policy for continuing the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and using drones and all that stuff is due to the desire for oil and resources vis-a-vis China? Is there some kind of pipeline involved in this? I was hearing about a pipeline. My second question is, How is the nationalization by Morales and by Kirchner down in South America, how is that affecting Exxon?
Good. So in Afghanistan, there was a fantasy going back to the Taliban days that they could build a pipeline to to ship natural gas from Turkmenistan, which lies to the northwest of Afghanistan, across to consumers in Pakistan and India. But Afghanistan's been way too unstable to actually go forward with that pipeline, and I don't think it'll be built anytime soon, to put it mildly. I don't think oil or gas is a motivation for the Obama administration in Afghanistan at all. I think the president wants to wind this war down as quickly as he can. But in any event, the reality for resources in Afghanistan is that China's free riding on American military investments, in the sense that the Chinese have a long-term interest in developing copper and iron ore and other minerals in Afghanistan. And they're basically sitting back watching the United States military attempt to stabilize the country so that they can then exploit those resources. I'm afraid American consumers are never likely to benefit from Afghanistan's copper. The Chinese might, though. And the second question was about, remind me, my, you know, senioritis, I'm just going to have to...
Philip, are you still with us?
Wait for a reminder.
I was completely focused on the Afghanistan question. If you can email it, I'm sorry. Feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Aging is a terrible
thing.
Nick,
maybe we'll try to, because these are really intense, we'll try to slice the questions.
Yes,
that's
yes.
What we'll do from now on. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Alec in Oakland. Hi, Alec.
Hello, Rose.
Hi.
There's somebody wee-whacking next to me. I don't know if you can hear me.
It's okay. Go for it.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to mention that there was a movie back in about 1970 starring James Caan. And sports teams played for industries, like weather, energy. So there were no countries anymore. And I've seen that coming for the last 40 years. So this, and it really ties into what Steve Cole's book is about.
Hmm. Yeah.
Is that movie Rollerball?
Rollerball,
okay.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He made it later, but I never saw the remake.
Okay.
The original, that was the backstory. It was about all just industries.
Yeah, it's funny. I spend a lot of time out in Pakistan and Afghanistan by accident of professional assignment when I was at the Washington Post. And in Pakistan, the big sport, the big national sport is cricket. And all of the teams are company teams, corporate teams. And it's and same in South Korea with baseball. You know, you watch their major leagues and it's the Samsung Lions against, you know, that world is already here, I'm afraid, in some places.
Well, and also forecasting. So you have Exxon forecasting to 2030. And we were talking before the show just about the future you foresee for your grandchildren, which you don't have yet, but you probably will. And you're just doing all this research. I mean, what do you see coming for future generations? Because we really are having that conversation in this country right now.
Well, I think the one thing that I concluded after all this looking at it was that the numbers are inexorable. And what the numbers say is that global warming that scientists today currently describe as dangerous will occur. We can't get ourselves out of it. So when I think about the world my grandchildren are going to live in, they're going to live in a warmer world. Now, what does that mean for them? I mean, we were joking, maybe they all move to Canada. I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a happy place for the most vulnerable populations in the world. I think climate change is likely to be much tougher on the world's poor than it is on the world's wealthy. Maybe the United States can adapt, but sounds like a grim future to consign to one's grandchildren if you have the power to prevent it, and we do, and yet we're not in a position to actually prevent it.
What will make us prevent it?
You know, I kept thinking about that as I was working on this because, you know, if there is pollution that threatens living generations, if you believe your child is at risk from dirty water or dirty air,
right,
you will pay a tax, you'll pay a price to prevent that, and you will insist that political leaders do something about it now.
Right.
But the problem with global warming is that the concrete risks that will cause your family members to suffer a fate that you wouldn't wish for them are too distant and too vague and too uncertain to cause us to impose a price on ourselves now. That's what we would have to do. We would have to tax ourselves in order to prevent this from coming. And we're willing to tax ourselves to stop acid rain from falling in the sky or from drinking dirty water, but we're not willing to do that about global warming yet. European populations have been willing. Australia just did it. But these are baby steps.
All right. Well, thank you again for the question. And we have an email from a listener over in Berkeley who says, does Steve believe that the American oil companies push the U.S. government to go to war in Iraq or to keep militarily threatening Iran to gain control of their oil?
You know, I worked hard on that question because I was very curious about it myself. And I was a little bit surprised to discover that ExxonMobil in particular, despite the friendship between Lee Raymond and Dick Cheney, was opposed to the invasion of Iraq. And that's because they want basically what they want is a stable world where it's where you can drill oil. That's what they don't want. War is bad. Peace and oil drilling is good. And so they were really more in the kind of what's sometimes called in foreign policy schools the realist camp. They wanted the United States to come to terms with Iran and stop this pattern of institutionalized enmity. They opposed the invasion. Now, once the invasion occurred and Saddam Hussein was overthrown, of course, then ExxonMobil sat patiently and looked for an opportunity to go into Iraq and take a position in its oil, which it did. And it now has two important positions in Iraqi oil that are a direct result of the fact that the Bush administration invaded the country. So that's typical that they kind of play it both ways.
It's also interesting to read in your book about the political philosophy of the Exxon executives, very dedicated people. When they're at Exxon, they're there for life,
yeah,
right?
Very unusual. Yeah, people come up out of college and don't leave, and nobody comes into that company at the top from another corporation, a competing company, or another industry. It's much more like the Marine Corps. You know, you don't... You come up together as a cohort. You rise. Those who are promoted rise together, and it's very insular. And that has a lot of consequences for the internal culture of the company, and even within the industry, they're seen that way. You go to a meeting, and there's a Chevron guy, and he might be there in a baseball hat, and there's a guy from Conoco. They're a little more conservative. The guys from the European companies look like, you know, Eurocrats, and then there's ExxonMobil, and they're all in white shirts and blue suits and red ties, and they have short haircuts, and they cluster together, and they're not very friendly, and they're not very good partners, and they're seen by their competitors as a world unto themselves, even within the mores and norms of the oil industry.
And very male-dominated.
Very male-dominated. One of their directors said something to me astonishing. He came from another industry, and he said, you know, I looked around at the top four or five executives, and I realized that all of the men at the top of the company, and there were only men, only had sons. Not a one of them had daughters. And he said, I'm in math, you know, I'm a mathematician. I went back and I did the math. And I said, this is impossible. So there is obviously a selection bias for men with sons. And then he said, well, how could that be? What is that about? Is it about hunting? Well, in fact, ExxonMobil has a huge hunting ranch in southern Texas where they do a lot of communing as executives rise together. But there are one or two women in this top 100 jobs of that company, I think. I mean, I haven't done the exact math, so I should be careful about making a specific claim, but there are very few women at the top of ExxonMobil, and it's a problem for them going forward. You look at the United States, who's graduating from college? Who's graduating from graduate school? Who are the future American scientists in this country? You know,
we do claim it. We're about 51% of the country.
Yeah, well, and also increasingly the better educated gender,
right,
in this country.
And so then things start to change when you get to the corporate world, which is for another show altogether.
Yes.
But the other thing that's interesting, I love the tidbits in your book about former CEO Lee Raymond. He was in the running to be the to run the American Enterprise Institute.
Right.
Right.
And then a colleague sort of said, you don't want to do that because those are the people who go around invading countries.
Right. And so
he backed off of that. And then he was up for the Kennedy Center.
That was the other interesting,
yeah,
right? And then the
Kennedy family said,
well,
we don't really want an ExxonMobil guy doing this.
So they don't align themselves with neocons.
They don't, actually. And because they want a stable world, and they don't like the idea of remaking the world in the name of democracy. The neocons, you know, do have a human rights agenda. ExxonMobil's not interested in promoting human rights because in many of the countries where it pumps oil, it would be problematic to promote human rights, and it would just irritate the dictator that's given them the contract.
So what is their end game?
They want, how would they see it? What is their vision? I think they would say that they want a stable, prosperous world where everybody can drive cars and there are no wars and everybody can drill for oil. And maybe we raise the price on oil gradually so as to slightly mitigate the risks of global warming. But there's no reason to panic about that because the science isn't certain and it's anyway far off in the future. And basically they have a kind of vision of almost cold technocratic stability out over the world, and also property rights. They need property rights and the rule of law and good governance so that they can reap the benefits of their contracts. And so, not all of that is bad, but it's very specific.
We're speaking with Steve Cole, author of the new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. And we've got about 10 minutes left. So if you have any questions or comments about the largest and most powerful private corporation in the U.S., we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What questions do you have about their vision? They've got this 2030 plan down, and you can bet they have done so many studies and they've done a lot of research about alternative energy. So if you really want answers about where we're going, it is really, Steve, a good idea to look at this 2030 plan. I learned a lot from this plan.
It is kind of fascinating, and I think it's reasonably reliable. A couple of the other big oil companies have done similar exercises. They all come down more or less the same place. But what, to me, the biggest benefit, at least the first time through trying to understand what it said, is that it does provide a kind of wall painting, a wall mural of what our global energy economy actually is. And so if you want to change it, you kind of have to start with an accurate understanding of what the shape of it is now.
We have one more question from our listener in Berkeley. He writes, Steve says that the oil companies want to own the oil, but most, if not all, non-European oil countries have nationalized their oil. Don't the major oil companies still make plenty of billions of dollars in record profits through that arrangement?
Great question. There are companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger go out and make their living as a contractor for nationalized oil companies, basically just the way you would hire a contractor to fix your house, but that contractor doesn't own your house. But what ExxonMobil very specifically wants, its whole business model is based on owning oil and gas, and they will not go anywhere where they cannot own the oil and gas. And the reality described by the listener is correct. Because there's so much nationalization, there are so many places rich with oil that ExxonMobil cannot go because they can't own it. And so the consequence is there are really only two parts of the world, as a general matter, where they can own oil and gas. One is in the free market West, where property rights are sacrosanct. Anything you can buy, you can own. But there hasn't been a lot of growth in oil and gas discovery here until recently. And then weak states that are too weak to do what the listener points out stronger states do, which is to nationalize and build up their own state oil companies. And so ExxonMobil ends up disproportionately in West Africa, for example, in Chad, in Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea. I mean, when I traveled in Chad, I mean, one of the questions, kind of basic questions I was asking myself is, why is ExxonMobil here? I mean, it's a fourth world country. It's a benighted place, beautiful people, amazing landscape, 11 million people, but they're 181st out of 187 countries on the Human Development Index published by the United Nations. Life expectancy is less than 50 years. I mean, it's a really tough place. Mm. And why would you go there to drill for oil when the answer is because they need it so desperately and there aren't that many places where they can own it?
Mm. Well, thank you for the question. And let's go to a few callers and then we will definitely talk about Indonesia before we end the show. Let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose. Great show.
Thank you.
I just want to say that this is just a great example of why we need the Sherman antitrust rules. When you're making half a trillion in revenue and over $100 billion in profits, this is insanity. And they've had a great deleterious effect, threat to our democracy. They're a bunch of propagandists. They use Edward Bernays to destroy the whole climate change issue, to take that completely off the table. And they're a great threat to countries around the world. These guys need to be broken up. And also, when Dick Cheney had his energy conference and they wouldn't tell who were at the meetings, I'll bet you Exxon was sitting at the table and probably Lee Raymond or one of his minions was sitting at the table. And they knew darn well what was going to happen in Iraq, and they were just getting ready to exploit the oil there.
Well, Andy, Steve writes about that, and you bring up two really good questions. We were actually talking about the breakup in 1911, mm-hmm. right, when you had Exxon merging with Standard Oil.
Standard Oil was the original monopoly that was broken up by the Supreme Court in 1911, and Exxon's a child of that breakup, basically.
Right, yeah. Thank you. So then, could we ever see something like that again?
Well, you know, it's American antitrust law is kind of in an interesting state of flux, and the problem with ExxonMobil's power is that it's concentrated on a global scale more than it is necessarily on a national scale, although I agree that their concentrated power in the United States is outsized and important and in all the ways that the listener described. The one thing that's really interesting is that basically every company. Every country in the world has a big, giant state-owned oil company. Ours is ExxonMobil, but we don't own it as a state, as a government, as a people. Instead, we have an entity that is the greatest source of concentrated private power in the United States, and its chief executive recently told Scouting magazine that his favorite book is Atlas Shrugged, mm-hmm. Ayn Rand's dystopian novel that's a kind of touchstone for libertarians. How do only in America would the chief executive of our largest corporation regard the government that gave birth to his company and his privileges as something deeply suspect? And so no wonder we don't trust this company. I mean, they don't trust the state that gave birth to them. So there is this kind of gap that really is unusual around the world.
You write extensively about the relationship between former chair Lee Raymond and Dick Cheney. You write that Cheney wanted, Lee Raymond flew to Washington about every other month and met privately with Cheney on many of his visits, about 2 to 3 times a year, specifically on the energy policy. You do write about whether they met or not. And
yeah, well, there was
some confusion over that.
Well, there was an ExxonMobil executive who had access to that particular group, but the interesting thing was coming to understand the real intimacy of the friendship between Raymond and Cheney. I came to realize, that meeting that we heard so much about mattered a lot less than the private access that Raymond had to Cheney at his home, where they just talk about the way of the world and latest developments in the oil patch in Saudi Arabia, that sort of place.
Just a quick question from Eric. Is it possible that Exxon has stopped progress or slowed progress of the development and deployment of electric cars and infrastructure?
I think they have been skeptical, and they have lobbied against policies that would promote the development of alternative energy in general. But I don't know exactly how to interpret that specific form of the question. They're very skeptical about electric cars, and they have lobbied against policies that would promote them.
Have you seen Who Killed the Electric Car?
I know of that film, but I haven't seen it.
You should definitely see that, because it definitely does touch on these issues. And again, I really want to talk about Indonesia, because you did travel there, and what you found through your FOIA request is incredible.
Well, there was a small war going on when Exxon bought Mobil, which owned this giant gas field in Aceh, the province of Indonesia. And it goes to the point we were talking about earlier about how these companies are in such weak states. And what they would say is, we end up in all these war zones because that's where the oil is. But what a case like the Indonesian war also suggests is that the presence of oil and gas development in a very poor and unstable country can itself be destabilizing, because those oil fields become the prize. I mean, when I went to Equatorial Guinea, I thought, you know what this country is? It's just a big bank waiting to be robbed by whoever can carry out a successful coup, because if you're in the presidential palace in this tiny oil-rich country, you've got a bank account in Switzerland instantly with $100 million in it. So why wouldn't you be motivated to start a guerrilla war or take over the palace? And in Indonesia, there was a much more long-standing separatist war, but the really disturbing part was the role that Indonesian military forces played protecting ExxonMobil's property, the torture they carried out, the detentions they carried out.
And the role of the Bush administration?
The Bush administration. So at a certain point, this guerrilla movement called the Free Aceh Movement was directly attacking ExxonMobil's property, and the Bush administration came in and said to the guerrillas, we have terrorist lists in the United States. If you don't stop attacking ExxonMobil, you're going to be on them. And literally the American envoy said to the guerrillas, do you really want us as your enemy? And they backed off.
You filed FOIA requests with the State Department seeking cables and other documents about this. Has this been reported before?
No. These were new cables that were released under this FOIA request.
So in our last minute and a half, what is the role of journalists to really probe a corporation like this and to really expose the information that you found? And do you find that you're all over the place right now in terms of media? Are they asking you the right questions? Do you think that they'll take this information and do additional reporting to continue uncovering this information?
I hope so. And I hope that one reason I was motivated to do the project was for myself as a journalist. I realized I'd spent all my career scrutinizing governmental power, when right around the corner was this very important institution in American and global life that no journalist, never mind myself, had bothered to knock on the door and try to take down. And it's, there are many such opportunities, so I hope maybe the book provides some kind of model for how to do this. It's hard work, and it requires resources and persistence.
Right, but as a longtime journalist, you've won two Pulitzers. It's really the responsibility of our media to really do this digging and find this information.
Well, the purpose of journalism is to hold power to account to the American people, and so you have to ask, where is that power located? And typically journalism says, well, it's in government, and that's a legitimate answer, but I think there's too much, like, clustering around government reporting and not enough attention paid to non-governmental power in the country.
Steve Cole is author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. They just climbed to the number one spot on the Fortune 500 list, bumping Walmart to number two. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rose. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for listening. And I am taking a quick break to ask you to support KALW, an independent local public radio. It's the first day of our May membership campaign, so please take this opportunity to increase your involvement with KALW and help build the base of support for this unique institution. You can become a member or renew your membership today at kalw.org. Important to note that we never sell or share your personal information. And as Steve said, it is journalists' responsibility to really dig and expose information about our power structure, to really expose information about the most powerful company in the United States and their relationship with the U.S. government. And Steve Cole does it in his new book, Private Empire. It's 600 pages, fascinating information about all of the major political players and 7 to 8 countries around the world. It's yours for a $120 donation to KALW. You can get it at kalw.org. 100% of Your Call is funded by you. We would not be here without you. $120 will send you Steve Cole's new book, Private Empire. You can find it kalw.org. On Your Call, we really have the independence to spend an hour talking about the largest and most powerful corporation in the world and opening up the phone lines and taking your emails. Just got an email from Charlie who says, Steve Cole is one of our great journalists. Your body of work is extraordinary. Thanks for your courage, persistence, deep thinking, and great writing. A few other listeners have said, thank you so much for spending the time to really dig in and let us know about what goes on behind the scenes at a corporation like Exxon. Learn more about it in Steve Cole's book, $120. Log on to KALW.org. We never sell or share your private information. And it's really important to note that we do not take funding from NPR in Washington. We don't share resources with other radio stations. We're totally independent. You will never hear on Your Call that this show is brought to you by ExxonMobil because we are listener supported and we want to keep it that way. $120 will send you Steve Cole's Private Empire. You can get it at kalw.org. We need a venue for serious and in-depth discussions. We need a venue to air the voices you do not hear in the national media, and we need a venue to ask the tough questions. Most importantly, we need a venue to really talk about solutions to the many problems we are facing, and we try to do that every day on Your Call. Support this kind of radio, kalw.org. $120, we will send you Steve Cole's new book, Private Empire. And thank you for supporting local public independent radio.